From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. The call came in on a quiet morning in the spring of 2003 from a stretch of coastal blufftop near San Diego that on any other day would have been simply beautiful. A woman had been found at the base of a cliff. Her husband, Robert Peterson, told the first officers on the scene that she had fallen, that it had been a terrible, senseless accident, the kind of thing that happens when you live near the edge of something and the ground beneath you gives way without warning. He was grief-stricken, they noted. He was devastated, and for a little while, the world believed him. It would not believe him for long. Christine Peterson was, by every account that survives her, the kind of person who made the people around her feel genuinely seen. Friends and family would later describe her to investigators and to the court in terms that carried real weight, not the polished, reflexive tributes that grief sometimes produces, but specific, textured memories of a woman who showed up. She was a devoted mother. She was warm in the way that takes effort, the kind of warmth you have to choose every day. She had built a life in San Diego that looked, from the outside, like the fulfillment of something carefully hoped for, a home, a family, a marriage that the people in her life believed to be solid. She was in her 30s, with years and plans and ordinary tomorrows still ahead of her, or so everyone around her assumed. She was not the kind of person anyone could easily imagine at the bottom of a cliff. And that, in the end, was part of what made the story Robert Peterson tried to tell so difficult to sustain. The sequence of events that prosecutors would later lay out for a jury began, as these stories so often do, not with violence but with distance. Somewhere in the months before Christine's death, according to testimony and evidence introduced at trial, something had shifted in the Peterson marriage. Robert, investigators would come to learn, had been involved in an extramarital affair. That relationship, prosecutors argued, had become a priority, emotionally, and perhaps in other ways too. And the financial architecture of Robert and Christine's life together, the kind of thing that rarely surfaces until someone starts looking carefully, began to matter in ways that it hadn't before. What detectives from the San Diego County Sheriff's Department and later, investigators working the case more deeply, would piece together was a picture of a man whose marriage had become, in his apparent calculus, an obstacle. Christine had life insurance. The home, the shared finances, the legal and economic entanglements of a long marriage, all of it, prosecutors would argue, stood between Robert Peterson and the life he seemed to want instead. This is the architecture of motive, and it is rarely pretty, and it is almost never simple. But the jury in time would find it persuasive. On the morning of the incident, Robert told investigators that he and Christine had gone for a walk near the bluffs, a coastal area not far from their San Diego home, the kind of place that is genuinely lovely and genuinely dangerous in equal measure. He said she had gone too close to the edge. He said the earth gave way, or she lost her footing, or some combination of the two that he described with the halting imprecision of a man in shock. She fell, he said. It was an accident. By the time emergency personnel reached the base of the cliff, Christine Peterson was dead. The initial response, and this is not unusual in cases where the scene appears consistent with an accidental fall, treated it as a tragic mishap. The rugged San Diego coastline has claimed lives before through nothing more sinister than inattention and misfortune. Investigators documented the scene. The death was reported, and Robert Peterson, in those first hours, presented himself as a husband in anguish. But the questions began almost immediately. The forensic examination of Christine Peterson's body was the first thread that investigators pulled. Medical examiners and forensic specialists, reviewing the nature and pattern of her injuries, began to raise concerns that were difficult to reconcile with a simple, unassisted fall. The precise findings were presented in detail at trial, and prosecutors argued that the physical evidence was not consistent with Christine having lost her footing and tumbled over the edge on her own. The injuries, the trajectory, the specifics that forensic science concerns itself with, all of it, according to the prosecution's expert witnesses, pointed towards something more deliberate than a misstep. This is the moment in these investigations when the atmosphere changes. It changes for the detectives working the case, who begin to look at the grieving husband not with sympathy, but with a different kind of attention. It changes for the family and friends of the victim, who start to feel the ground shift beneath their own understanding of what has happened. And it changes, in the most consequential sense, for the man who has been telling a story about an accident, because the people whose job it is to determine the truth have begun, quietly and methodically, to doubt him. Investigators began to look more carefully at Robert Peterson's life. The affair, which had not been a secret to everyone, came into focus as something more than a personal failing. Prosecutors would argue that it represented a sustained commitment to another woman, one that Robert had been unable or unwilling to end, and that it existed in direct tension with his marriage to Christine. Evidence of the relationship was documented and presented to the jury, not as a moral judgment, though jurors are human beings and cannot be expected to receive such things in a vacuum, but as a component of the motive the prosecution was constructing. The financial evidence was developed alongside this. Court records reflect that prosecutors argued Robert Peterson stood to benefit materially from Christine's death, that life insurance proceeds and the restructuring of their shared financial life would have served his interests in ways that her continued existence did not. These are the calculations that investigators look for, and finding them does not prove guilt, but they form a pattern. And patterns matter when a jury is asked to decide what happened on a bluff top on an ordinary morning. Robert Peterson's account of events was examined and re-examined. Investigators spoke with him multiple times, and the details, as documented in the case records, did not always hold together with the consistency that a truthful account tends to produce. The scene at the cliff was analyzed. The timeline was reconstructed. And piece by piece, the architecture of what prosecutors called a murder began to take shape. The turning point in the investigation, the moment that shifted the case from a suspicious death inquiry to a murder prosecution, came when the totality of the evidence was assembled and presented to prosecutors for review. The medical examiner's conclusions about Christine's injuries, the evidence of Robert's affair and his financial motives, the inconsistencies in his own account, and the physical evidence gathered from the scene were woven together into a case that the San Diego County District Attorney's Office determined was sufficient to bring to trial. Robert Peterson was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. The charge of first-degree murder carries with it the allegation of premeditation and deliberation, that whatever happened at the top of that cliff was not a moment of sudden passion or accident, but something planned, something decided. Prosecutors were prepared to argue exactly that. They were prepared to stand before a jury and say that Robert Peterson had not merely committed a crime, but had calculated one, had chosen the moment and the method and the setting, and had then constructed a story of grief and accident intended to conceal what he had done. The trial of Robert Peterson in San Diego County in 2004 unfolded over a period of weeks, with prosecutors and defense attorneys presenting sharply divergent accounts of who Robert Peterson was and what had happened to his wife. The prosecution called expert witnesses, forensic specialists, medical professionals, who testified about the physical evidence and what it suggested about the manner of Christine's death. They called witnesses who testified about the affair, about Robert's behavior in the period leading up to Christine's death, and about the financial circumstances that, prosecutors argued, had given him reason to want her gone. The defense, for its part, maintained that Christine's death had been a tragic accident, that the forensic evidence was susceptible to interpretation, and that the prosecution was constructing a narrative of motive and guilt around a man who had simply suffered an unimaginable loss. Defense attorneys challenged the expert testimony, questioned the conclusions drawn from the physical evidence and argued that the affair and the financial circumstances, troubling as they might appear, did not amount to proof that Robert Peterson had murdered his wife. The jury listened, they deliberated, and when they returned their verdict, they found Robert Peterson guilty of first-degree murder. The finding meant that 12 ordinary people, having heard all of it, the forensic evidence, the testimony about the affair, the financial record, Robert's own account and its inconsistencies, concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that Christine Peterson had not fallen, that she had been pushed, that the man who had stood at the top of that cliff and called for help had been the agent of her death and had known it. Robert Peterson was sentenced to 25 years to life in a California state prison. He would be eligible for parole consideration after serving that minimum term, but the sentence placed his fate in the hands of a system that takes the gravity of first-degree murder seriously and has, for decades, the appeals process, which is the right of every convicted defendant and an important safeguard of a system that is not infallible, proceeded in the years following conviction. Robert Peterson's attorneys raised legal challenges to the conviction, as is both their obligation and his right under the law. California's appellate courts reviewed those challenges, examining the record of the trial, the evidence presented, the legal standards applied. The conviction was upheld. The appellate courts, having reviewed what the jury saw, found no basis to disturb the verdict. Robert Peterson remained in the California state prison system, serving his sentence for the murder of his wife. As of the most recent available records, that remains his legal status. A convicted murderer, serving a sentence of 25 years to life, the product of a jury's considered judgment and an appellate system's review. There is something that stays with you in a case like this one, not the forensics, not the legal maneuvering, not even the verdict itself, though all of those things matter. What stays is the portrait of Christine Peterson, a woman who, by every account, loved her life and the people in it, who trusted the person who shared her home, who had no reason on that morning to imagine that ordinary day would be her last. She went for a walk near a place that was beautiful, near the edge of something, with her husband beside her. The people who loved Christine Peterson have had to carry the knowledge of how she died and of who the evidence says was responsible, and that is not a burden that verdicts dissolve. Courts can adjudicate guilt. They cannot undo loss. Christine was a mother, a friend, a daughter, a person whose absence left a shape in other people's lives that has not been filled and cannot be. The jury's verdict gave her family something, perhaps, a name for what happened, a legal accounting, a measure of something that we reach for when we say the word justice, even knowing that the word is always larger than what the law can actually provide. Robert Peterson presented himself in those first hours as the perfect husband, undone by grief, destroyed by loss. What investigators found, and what prosecutors argued, and what a jury ultimately concluded, was something else entirely. It was a performance, deliberate and practiced, constructed over the body of a woman who deserved so much better than to be the supporting character in someone else's deception. The California coast is still beautiful. The bluffs above San Diego still catch the light in the morning, in a way that stops people in their tracks. Somewhere in that landscape is the place where Christine Peterson's life ended, and the world kept moving anyway, the way the world always does, sometimes cruelly and sometimes just because that is simply the nature of things, that they continue, whether we are ready or not. Christine Peterson was 30-something years old and had years she never got to live. That is the fact at the center of all the forensics and testimony and legal proceedings, and it is the fact that deserves the last word, not the verdict, though it matters, not the sentence, though justice demanded it, her, a woman who deserved to see what came next. Our next case takes us to Clallam County, Washington. There is a moment, somewhere in the long arc of a murder investigation, when the most troubling realization sets in, not that a killer is hard to find, but that he isn't hiding at all. In the summer of 2012, Clallam County Sheriff's deputies found themselves in precisely that situation. Two men were dead, shot, and the man who would ultimately be charged with killing them had, in the days and weeks beforehand, told people exactly what he intended to do. He had a list. He had a reason, at least by his own accounting. And when the time came, he carried it out. This is a story about vigilante logic, the cold, self-righteous arithmetic of a man who decided he alone had the authority to pronounce sentences and carry them out. It is also a story about two human beings whose pasts made them vulnerable, who were living under the scrutiny of the law, and who were killed anyway. Not by the system they were registered in, by a neighbor who had appointed himself their judge. Gary Lee Blanton, Jr., was 47 years old in the summer of 2012. He lived in Sequim, a small town on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, that quiet, fog-softened stretch of the Pacific Northwest, where the mountains meet the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and where people sometimes go precisely because they want to be left alone. Blanton had a history that had brought him into contact with the criminal justice system, and his name appeared on Washington's Sex Offender Registry. That registry was public. His address was not hidden. Jerry Ray, who was 64, also lived in Clallam County. He, too, was a registered sex offender. He had served his time. He had registered as required by law. He was, by the letter of those requirements, doing what the state had asked of him, living in the open, in the community, accountable. Neither man, according to everything that has been reported about this case, had any known personal conflict with Patrick Drum. They were not his enemies in any conventional sense. They were, in Drum's apparent worldview, simply names on a list he had constructed from the public registry, a list that represented, to him, something like a mission. Patrick Drum was 30 years old. He had grown up in the area. People who knew him described someone who had strong feelings about the protection of children, feelings that had curdled, over time, into something darker and more absolute. He had, according to reporting by the Peninsula Daily News and other regional outlets, spoken openly to acquaintances about wanting to kill sex offenders. Some accounts suggest he had been doing this for years, not in hushed, conspiratorial tones, but plainly, as though it were a matter he had simply resolved within himself and was waiting for the right conditions to act upon. In late May 2012, those conditions arrived. On May 27, 2012, Patrick Drum went to Gary Blanton's residence in Sequim. What happened inside that home in the precise sequence of moments will never be fully knowable from the outside, but the result was unambiguous. Gary Blanton was shot and killed. Drum left. He did not flee the county. He did not, by all accounts, appear to experience the kind of panic that follows an impulsive act, because what prosecutors would later argue in court, and what the evidence would strongly support, was that this was not an impulsive act at all. 2 days later, on May 29th, Patrick Drum went to Jerry Ray's home in the Joyce area of Clallam County. Jerry Ray was also shot and killed. Two men, 2 days apart, both on the registry, both dead. The investigation that followed was not, as these things sometimes go, a slow unraveling. There was no years-long cold case here, no forensic puzzle that required painstaking reconstruction. The Clallam County Sheriff's Office, working the homicides, found Patrick Drum within days. The evidence pointing to him was not subtle, and when deputies caught up with him, Drum did not deny what he had done. Quite the opposite. According to court records and extensive media coverage, Drum spoke freely about his motivations. He described himself, in essence, as a protector, a man doing what the community was too timid or too law-bound to do. He had, he explained, targeted registered sex offenders. He viewed his actions not as crimes but as a service. Investigators, to their credit, understood immediately that this kind of stated ideological motive, however sincerely it may have been held, did not transform premeditated killing into anything other than what it was. Two men were dead. The law does not recognize a citizen's right to execute other citizens based on a registry entry, a past conviction, or a personal moral calculus, however passionately held. Drum was arrested and charged with 2 counts of aggravated first-degree murder. The case was prosecuted in Clallam County Superior Court. The prosecution's task, in some respects, was straightforward. The evidence of premeditation was considerable, and the defendant had essentially narrated his own intent. But the defense had its own strategy, one that leaned into the strange, uncomfortable cultural territory the case had stumbled into. There was, it should be said, a segment of public reaction to Patrick Drum's arrest that was not entirely condemnatory. Online forums in 2012 churned with a certain faction of commenters who described him as a hero, as a man who had done what needed doing. His legal defense fund received donations. Letters arrived expressing support. This was not, of course, a legal argument, but it was a social pressure that surrounded the trial, and that made the proceedings feel freighted with a significance beyond the particulars of one man in one county. The defense, for its part, did not argue that Drum hadn't committed the killings. The evidence made that untenable. Instead, the approach centered on mitigation, on presenting Drum's background, his psychology, his stated beliefs, in an effort to influence the jury's weighing of the charges and, ultimately, the sentence. Drum himself, according to trial coverage in the Peninsula Daily News and Seattle area news outlets, remained consistent in his framing throughout. He did not express remorse in the conventional sense. He expressed, from all accounts, a kind of grim conviction that he had done the right thing. The jury, after hearing the evidence and the arguments, did not agree with that framing. In 2013, Patrick Drum was found guilty on both counts of aggravated first-degree murder. The jury also found the aggravating factors that elevated the crimes to their most serious classification. Under Washington state law, a finding of aggravated first-degree murder carries a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. That is what Patrick Drum received. He appealed. In the years following his conviction, Drum pursued appellate review of his case, as is his legal right. Those appeals have not succeeded. His conviction has remained intact. As of the reporting available on this case, Patrick Drum is serving 2 concurrent life sentences without the possibility of parole in the Washington State Department of Corrections. There is a particular kind of horror that attaches itself to cases like this one, not the horror of mystery, but the horror of clarity. We know what happened. We know why the defendant said he did it. And knowing does not make it easier to sit with. What makes the Drum case worth pausing over, even a decade on, is the question it forces to the surface about what it means to live in a society governed by law rather than by the convictions of whoever happens to be the most certain in any given moment. Gary Blanton and Jerry Ray had committed crimes in their pasts. They had been convicted by juries, sentenced by judges, required to register and be known to their communities. The system, imperfect, contested, endlessly debated, had processed them. Whatever one believes about sex offender registries, about rehabilitation, about justice and punishment, and the possibility of a person's life after a serious crime, the answer that Patrick Drum provided was not a legal or a moral one. It was simply violence. The people who sent him letters of support may have believed otherwise, but the courtroom, in the end, is where those beliefs meet the facts. Gary Blanton was 47 years old. He had a life in Sequim, in that misty green corner of Washington State. Jerry Ray was 64, old enough that he might reasonably have hoped the remaining chapters of his story would be quiet ones. Neither of them had any reason, on those late May mornings, to know that a man with a list and a gun had decided their chapters were already finished. There is no version of that sentence that is anything other than what it is. Patrick Drum now has the rest of his life, inside a correctional facility, without the possibility of release, to sit with what he decided on those 2 days in 2012. The community he said he was protecting has moved on. The case became a cautionary note in regional journalism about vigilante ideology and the dangers of a certain kind of zealotry that wraps itself in the language of protection. Researchers and policy advocates have pointed to it. It has been cited in discussions about the unintended consequences of public sex offender registries, how the ready availability of names and addresses can, in rare but catastrophic cases, serve not as a tool of community awareness, but as a targeting mechanism for someone who has already decided to act. Two men are buried, a man is in prison, and somewhere in that triangle of facts is a lesson that the law keeps trying, in its patient, grinding way, to teach, that the authority to take a life does not belong to the certain. It doesn't belong to the righteous. It doesn't belong to anyone who decides, alone in the privacy of his own conviction, that the time has come. That authority does not exist. The last lie that vigilante logic tells itself is that it is justice. The courts of Clallam County and the jury that sat through the testimony and the evidence and the defendant's own unapologetic account of what he had done found otherwise. Our next case takes us to Atlanta, Georgia. The morning of March 11, 2005, began the way most Friday mornings begin inside the Fulton County Courthouse in downtown Atlanta, with the low hum of bureaucracy, the shuffle of case files, the particular exhausted routine of a building that processes human misery on an industrial scale. Lawyers compared notes in hallways. Clerks refilled coffee cups. And on the 8th floor, in a holding area just off courtroom 8C, a deputy sheriff named Cynthia Hall was escorting a large, powerfully built defendant back from a restroom. His name was Brian Nichols. He was 33 years old, a former college football player, and he was on trial for rape. Within the next 60 seconds, the morning would shatter into something this city and this country would not soon forget. What happened next, prosecutors would later lay out in meticulous, documented detail. Nichols overpowered Deputy Hall, took her weapon, and walked through a door that should not have been easy to walk through. He walked into a courtroom. He walked into history. Before we follow him down that terrible path, it is worth pausing, as these stories always demand we pause, to remember the people whose lives were changed and lost that day. Because in the sweep of what became a national news event, a spectacle of manhunts and hostage negotiations and courthouse reform hearings, it can be too easy to lose sight of the human beings at the center of it. Judge Roland Barnes had served on the Fulton County Superior Court bench since 1994. He was 64 years old, a man of deliberate speech and Southern courtesy, known among attorneys who practiced in his courtroom for his patience and his fairness. He had spent decades in the legal profession, first as a lawyer, then as a judge, and those who knew him described a man who genuinely believed in the law as a civilizing force. He had a wife, a family, a life built around public service. He had presided over Brian Nichols's rape trial, and on that Friday morning he was in his courtroom doing his job. Julie Ann Brandau was his court reporter. She was 46, a professional who had spent years translating the spoken language of courtrooms into the permanent written record. Her colleagues remembered her as competent, warm, someone who made the machinery of justice run a little more smoothly just by showing up. She had a family, too, people who loved her, people who would spend the rest of their lives marking time from that Friday in March. Sergeant Hoyt Teasley was a Fulton County deputy who encountered Nichols during his flight from the courthouse. He was 40 years old, a man in uniform doing the dangerous and underappreciated work that courthouse security demands. And David Wilhelm was a federal agent with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, 43 years old, whose path crossed Nichols's during the desperate hours that followed. These were four people with full lives, with futures that were taken from them before the sun went down. The timeline that prosecutors reconstructed at trial, and that was corroborated by physical evidence, witness testimony, and surveillance footage, begins in that holding area on the 8th floor. At approximately 9 in the morning, Deputy Hall, a petite woman, was escorting Nichols when he attacked her. According to court records, he beat her severely. She would survive but suffer serious injuries and took her service weapon. He then proceeded into courtroom 8C. Judge Barnes was on the bench. The courtroom was beginning its morning session. What happened there took only moments. The jury found, after deliberation on the evidence presented at trial, that Nichols shot and killed Judge Roland Barnes and Julie Ann Brandau inside that courtroom. The recording devices that Brandau had been operating captured sounds that investigators later described in court. It was, by any measure, one of the most violent intrusions into a court of law in American history. Nichols fled. He made his way out of the courthouse and onto the streets of downtown Atlanta. He carjacked a vehicle, and in the parking garage adjacent to the courthouse, he encountered Sergeant Hoyt Teasley. Prosecutors argued, and the jury found, that Nichols shot and killed Sergeant Teasley in that garage. Three people were dead, and Nichols had a car and a weapon and a head start. The city erupted. Law enforcement agencies across the Atlanta metropolitan area mobilized. The courthouse was locked down. The story went national within the hour, the kind of story that interrupts regular programming, that crawls across the bottom of television screens in airports and waiting rooms. Brian Nichols's face was everywhere. He was described as armed, dangerous, and desperate, a man who had, in the space of a few minutes, committed acts that guaranteed he had nothing left to lose. He drove. He abandoned vehicles and acquired others. He moved through the city with a kind of terrible, improvised logic, staying ahead of the dragnet that was drawing tighter around him. At some point during that long Friday, investigators later documented, he traveled to the Buckhead neighborhood of Atlanta. There, according to court records, he encountered David Wilhelm, the federal ICE agent, at Wilhelm's home. He shot and killed him, four people dead. The city was in a state of controlled terror. And then, as Friday turned into Saturday morning, the story took a turn that would eventually find its way into books and films and sermons, though it belongs here simply as documented fact. Ashley Smith was 26 years old. She was a young woman living in an apartment in the suburb of Duluth, and she had her own story, a complicated, painful one, involving loss and struggle that she has since spoken about publicly and in detail. In the early hours of Saturday, March 12th, she returned to her apartment and encountered Brian Nichols. According to her own account, given to law enforcement and later corroborated, he forced his way into her apartment and held her at gunpoint. What followed over the next several hours became one of those strange, human chapters that true crime occasionally produces. Not a chapter we can fully explain, only document. Smith talked to Nichols through the night. She made him breakfast. She read to him from a book she had with her, a Christian devotional called The Purpose-Driven Life. She told him, she later said, about her young daughter. She humanized herself to him in the most fundamental and desperate sense of that word. By the time morning came, by the time Smith was able to call 911, after Nichols allowed her to leave to visit her daughter, he had not harmed her. Law enforcement descended on that Gwinnett County apartment complex rapidly. The standoff was brief. Brian Nichols surrendered without further violence, and the manhunt that had gripped Atlanta for roughly 26 hours came to an end. Ashley Smith was not injured. She later wrote a memoir about the experience. Whether you understand what happened in that apartment as divine intervention, as the unpredictable psychology of a desperate man, or as the extraordinary courage of a young woman who found a way to stay alive through her humanity, it remains one of the documented facts of this case. She survived, and she talked him down. The investigation that followed Nichols's capture was, in one sense, straightforward. He was caught. The physical evidence connecting him to all four killings was extensive: ballistic evidence, surveillance footage, witness testimony, his own presence at the scene of each crime. The challenge was not proving what he had done. The challenge, as it turned out, was getting the case to trial. The state of Georgia charged Brian Nichols with 54 counts, including 4 counts of murder. What followed was one of the most prolonged and expensive pretrial processes in Georgia history. The case churned through years of legal proceedings, questions about funding for the defense, questions about representation, questions about venue and procedure. The state's public defender system was strained nearly to the breaking point by the sheer cost of preparing a capital defense in a case of this complexity. At various points, the proceedings seemed to be collapsing under their own weight, mired in funding crises and procedural battles that frustrated everyone involved. The prosecution, the defense, the victims' families, and a public that had been waiting, year after year, for the case to actually be tried. Ultimately, after years of delays, the trial of Brian Nichols began in 2008, 3.5 years after the crimes themselves. The trial was held in Fulton County Superior Court, in the same system where Roland Barnes had served as a judge, which gave the proceedings a particular gravity. The prosecution presented its case methodically. Physical evidence was paramount. Forensic testimony linked Nichols to each of the four killings through ballistic analysis and other physical documentation. Surveillance footage from the courthouse showed his movements on the morning of March 11th. Witnesses testified to what they had seen and heard. The chain of events prosecutors laid out was comprehensive and documented at every link. The defense did not dispute that Brian Nichols had committed the acts in question. Their argument, the argument they had been preparing through all those years of pretrial maneuvering, was that Brian Nichols suffered from a serious mental illness, that he was not legally responsible for what he had done because he did not, at the time, understand the criminality of his conduct. Psychiatric experts testified on his behalf, describing what defense attorneys argued was a delusional state, a break from reality so severe that he could not be held legally culpable. Prosecutors countered with their own expert testimony, arguing that Nichols knew exactly what he was doing, that he had planned to escape from custody, that his actions were purposeful and directed, that a man acting on pure delusion does not successfully evade capture for more than 24 hours in a major metropolitan area. The jury was asked to weigh that question with the gravity it deserved. On November 7, 2008, after deliberating for less than 2 days, they returned their verdict, guilty, on all 54 counts. The courtroom, by accounts of journalists who were present, was quiet in the way that large rooms sometimes go quiet when something irrevocable has been settled. The families of the four victims had waited 3.5 years for this moment. Then came the sentencing phase. And here, the case took one more unexpected turn. The same jury that convicted Nichols on all counts could not reach a unanimous decision on whether to sentence him to death. Georgia law required unanimity for a death sentence. The jury was deadlocked. Reportedly, a single juror held out against execution, and so the decision on punishment passed to the judge, who was bound by law to impose the alternative sentence, life in prison without the possibility of parole. On each of the four murder counts, Brian Nichols received that sentence. He also received additional consecutive sentences on the remaining counts. He would die in prison. The conviction did not end the legal proceedings. Appellate challenges followed, as they do in virtually every major capital or near-capital case. Nichols's attorneys raised issues about jury selection, about the conduct of the trial, about the handling of evidence. The appeals wound through the Georgia court system over the years that followed. Courts reviewed the record, and the conviction held. As of the time of this reporting, Brian Nichols remains incarcerated, serving multiple consecutive life sentences, his appeals exhausted or denied. The verdict and sentences stand as adjudicated. What the case left behind extended well beyond the courtroom. The Fulton County Courthouse killing of a sitting judge and a court reporter inside an active courtroom sent immediate shockwaves through courthouse security policy across the entire country. Studies were commissioned. Protocols were rewritten. The question of how a defendant in a custody situation had been escorted to and from a restroom by a single, smaller deputy, became the subject of intense scrutiny and, eventually, institutional reform. Many jurisdictions around the country reviewed and overhauled their procedures for handling defendants in transit within courthouse facilities. The staffing ratios, the physical designs, the checkpoint systems. If there is any legacy that the living might hope to extract from these deaths, it is perhaps found there. In the systems that were changed, the policies that were written, the tragedies that may have been prevented in courtrooms we will never know about because the failures that made this one possible were, at least in part, addressed. There is something that lingers about this case beyond its legal resolution, beyond the reforms, beyond the years of trials and appeals. It has to do with the strange geography of that Saturday morning in a suburban apartment. A young woman sitting across from a man who had done terrible things, reading to him, talking to him, keeping herself alive through sheer human connection. Ashley Smith has said in the years since that she was not afraid, or that she was afraid and did it anyway. The distinction matters less than the fact, and it has to do with Roland Barnes and Julie Ann Brandau and Hoyt Teasley and David Wilhelm, four people who simply showed up to do their work on an ordinary Friday morning and did not go home. Their families marked the years. The anniversaries came and went, as they always do. The legal proceedings concluded. The institution moved on, reformed itself, tried to learn its lesson. But the work of grief does not proceed on a legal timeline. It doesn't conclude when a jury returns a verdict, or when an appellate court denies a final petition, or when a state law is amended to require an additional deputy in a courthouse hallway. We can only acknowledge it here, in the way that every story like this one finally demands. Not with resolution, because there is none, but with the simple, inadequate recognition that these were real people, that their loss was real, and that no sentence handed down in a courtroom in November of 2008 could give back a single one of the hours that were taken. That work is quieter, longer, more private, and it belongs entirely to the people who carry it. From them on a March morning when everything was supposed to be ordinary. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intellijix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.